Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Hello. Good morning, everyone. This is Danny Nesvetterani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, as well as your host for this hour of Speak Up. Before we start today's episode, I just want to acknowledge that we are here broadcasting, recording on the unceded and ancestral lands of the Hulkumalum and Squamish-speaking peoples who have been here since time immemorial, sharing, living, existing on this land. And I feel very extremely fortunate and privileged to be able to broadcast and share the talk programming and news that we do here at CJSF. And as part of CJSF's mandate and mission and overall values, we try to include a lot of talk pieces and stories and news segments that delve into specific topics regarding indigeneity and indigenous topics and issues throughout the greater Vancouver area. And for that reason, and because it is the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, I am going to be playing a series of segments that myself, as well as my colleague and programming coordinator here at CJSF 90.1 FM, Jesse Wensloff, have produced over the past year that all have to do with different Indigenous communities and nations and peoples and their stories and their experiences. So without further ado, I am going to start this episode off with a piece that I produced very recently. This one has to do with the First Peoples Gathering House here at SFU, which opened only a couple weeks ago, and I was able to attend the opening for that event. And it was a really beautiful space, a really beautiful event, and I really encourage anyone who is in this area to go and see the area for yourself, possibly get set up for an event. The building is open for guests, but pre-invited guests. So if there is some avenue to go and see this building or be a part of an event that happens in this building, I implore you. Anyways, without further ado, here is that piece. On September 12th, the First Peoples Gathering House on Simon Fraser University's Burnaby campus opened its doors to the public. First announced in September of 2020, the First Peoples Gathering House has been discussed as a ceremonial longhouse that will serve to celebrate Indigenous knowledge and culture at SFU. The Gathering House represents the four host nations whose unceded traditional lands SFU Burnaby was built on: the Musqueam Nation, the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, the Squamish Nation, and the Coquitlam Nation. Before the opening ceremony, CJSF was able to get an inside look of the First Peoples Gathering House, where we spent time in the building's Great Hall. The space has very intentionally been wrapped inside and out with cedar, a traditional longhouse building material. While looking through the space, we were able to speak with Eldon Yellowhorn, an SFU professor with the Department of Indigenous Studies and a member of the building committee for the First Peoples Gathering House. While the plans for this building are only several years old, according to Yellowhorn, its creation has been talked about since his time at SFU in the 1990s.
Prior to this, the Indigenous community didn't really have much of a footprint here on campus. And this building really stands in stark contrast to that brutalist style of architecture that is, you know, very part of Arthur Erickson's design. And this creates kind of an architectural dialogue between the very organic ideas of this space and the concrete and edged corners of the rest of the university.
Yellowhorn then went on to describe more of the architectural intentions of the First People's Gathering House.
The way we designed the place with the architect, you know, taking the traditional or the vernacular architecture of local First Nations and using that as the template for creating the physical structure so that even somebody walking past here, it takes like 2 minutes to walk past here, but they'll learn something about First Nations people in that time. So we designed it. Everything is designed to highlight the local culture from the interior design, but also the landscape. We used native plants to do the landscaping and kind of really emphasizing local area, the local area and what it means. Like the place, Lukluk-Waitin, the place of arbutus trees. And so we're looking, even if you look at the outside of the building, it's designed to look like arbutus trees, the bark of arbutus trees, you know, and as the building ages, it'll take on that resemblance more.
Lastly, we asked Eldon Yellowhorn what the community response and interest have been so far for the First People's Gathering House.
Oh, well, we've already had a lot of interest in the space, you know, for people wanting to hold special classes, to invite guest speakers who are coming to SFU, but also to hold special gatherings for their departments. So we're just waiting until after the opening is done, and then we'll start taking bookings. And by then, we'll have a fee structure on how much we'll be charging for the use of the space and whatnot.
In the Great Hall of the First People's Gathering House, there are four house posts that have been carved by a member of each of the four host nations. Before the opening, we had the opportunity to speak with Lyle Sparrow, a carver from the Musqueam Nation, who shared with us the personal meaning of the house post that he carved and what it depicts.
When the Kamloops thing came out, given our past history on the boarding schools, I just wanted to honor the ones that were left and never found. So that's the meaning behind the pole, is Mother Earth on the bottom, giving, passing the young ones up to grandfather and freeing them. I don't know, there's just a lot of bad history about it, and my parents went through it, and it wasn't until later years that I found out, you know, what had happened to them, and, you know, sort of had me in a mode of thinking of, you know, like the other people across this country that went through the, you know, similar things, and, you know, just to honor them and, you know, give some healing to the ones that are still here and free the ones that are not. And, you know, thanks to Kamloops, it's worldwide. You know, it's not something that you can dismiss anymore and say, no, it never happened. It happened, and, you know, like I said, I'm kind of proud of my parents, too, where they never really brought it up about what really happened to them in the boarding schools. But when I learned what did happen, it sort of hurts the heart.
Lyle Sparrow then went on to explain his personal experience carving this house post and some of what it brought up for him.
I mean, there were some days where it was hard, you know, because my mind is, you know, with the pole, what I was doing. And then, but at the same time, thinking back on, you know, different things that came to light as I was growing up. You know, so like I said, there were hard days and there were good days.
Later in the day, the public opening ceremony began, which included opening words from local Indigenous elders from the Squamish and Musqueam Nations, as well as various song and dance performances, including from the Red Tail Spirit Singers. Now that the First Peoples Gathering House at the SFU Burnaby campus has opened, it will be available to pre-invited guests from 8:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., Monday to Friday. This has been Danny Nezvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. We are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Danny Nezvadarani, once again your host for this hour. And coming up next, we have another piece that I produced earlier this year. And this was with a representative of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation on their kelp restoration project that has actually been proving to have some very beneficial effects on the local environment and also works a lot towards educating the youth of the nation on their ancestral lands. So take a listen for that. Since 2023, the Tsleil-Waututh Nation worked in partnership with the Kelp Rescue Initiative on bull kelp restoration in North Vancouver at Cates Park and New Brighton Park. Kelp forests in the Burrard Inlet have been facing rising ocean temperatures that have led to declines in kelp forests in the Salish Sea and around the world. According to the nation's Treaty, Lands, and Resources Department, even though there are groups focused on kelp restoration in British Columbia, there is no current standard bull kelp restoration method being applied across the region. The nation wanted to address this by developing strategies that can be successful in the Burrard Inlet to work against these declines and to motivate local industry to aid in bull kelp restoration efforts. To learn more about the impacts of this kelp restoration, we sat down for a conversation with Michelle George, Tsleil-Waututh Nation's cultural and technical specialist, where we were able to gain some insight on the effects this restoration project has had on the nation's underwater ecosystems since 2023. Please take a listen.
Tsleil-Waututh has been doing restoration projects for over the last 30 years, and it's a part of our initiative to clean up the waterways and surrounding lands. And so we've done restoration projects in estuaries and stuff, and we've been focusing on kelp and eelgrass. And specifically, this kelp project is sort of the first of its kind for us. So we're learning the process, how to harvest kelp from other areas, how to transplant it into new areas that aren't growing it. And it's sort of also a learning process for us. The methods for transplanting include securing kelp onto ceramic plates, to put it simply, and then putting those on the seabed and hoping that they flower and seed new bull kelp. And that's a really high-level, non-technical overview of the project.
Thank you. I think that does a good job of summarizing it all. Aside from the restoration aspect of the project, I wanted to know if there was also an educational part as well, particularly with the youth of the Tsleil-Waututh Nation, regarding the history and the importance of kelp within these ecosystems.
So Tsleil-Waututh have used Burrard Inlet since time out of mind. And so we used it for transportation, cultural activities, and food. And then up until 1792, we used it freely and every day. Unfortunately, after contact, that changed. and a lot of other industrial colonizing practices changed the way that we use the waterways. And so because of the pollution and devastation, some of our members don't access the waterways as they once did, or understand some of the resources that we used to harvest from the waterways. So a part of that is bringing community, specifically our school kids, out to these restoration areas and having them participate in these projects. Not specifically related to kelp, but we did have our students out there tying eelgrass to washers to sink them into the other projects that we've done. And so their hands-on approach, not only did they actually get to learn about the bull kelp and other kelps, traditional practices, traditional uses, and then also getting them out on the land with elders and other knowledge holders so that there's cultural exchange and education going on as well. So scientifically, but then also culturally, they're learning from all levels of not only our employees, but elders and community members.
Another thing that I found really fascinating about this project had to do with how this kelp restoration is sort of working against certain current forces, whether that be the ongoing effects of colonization or how that connects to climate change, which is ever present. And I also know that this is not the first attempt with this restoration project. There was a previous attempt in a past year that wasn't as successful. How did the nation sort of adapt and change the strategies around the restoration project in order for it to become more of a success?
Well, I think doing a little of the monitoring, assessing where we put it, where we selected sites, and then knowing what kind of ecosystem kelp needs to flourish in. So having multiple sites is in a way beneficial and helps the production of it. And then having, in a sense, more options, different scenarios where it has a chance to succeed, and then understanding where it's not succeeding so that we don't replant there or waste attempts there.
And is there a specific site in particular where you're seeing the most success?
I believe our out of the sites that we picked, I think New Brighton's one of the more successful sites.
Another thing I found really interesting about this project had to do with the various ways that kelp restoration can help these ecosystems. I was wondering if that's something you've been seeing and if that's something you can speak to.
The whole point of kelp and restoring the waterways is to help the forage fish. The forage fish are a major player within the food web, and is the herring. So in the 1860s, herring was completely harvested, exasperated from Burrard Inlet due to dynamite fishing. And it wasn't really known that it was such a huge part of Tsleil-Waututh diet that because it wasn't available for the last 100 years plus. And in the last 4 to 5 years, we've had a major herring return within Burrard Inlet. And I think that also attributes to the return of killer whales within Burrard Inlet as well. So herring and killer whales, which we haven't seen in decades, have started to return to Burrard Inlet.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying is that the kelp restoration is helping with the local herring populations, which is in turn benefiting the local killer whales as well as other sea life.
I believe so.
Do you hope that this project is able to inspire other communities to adopt similar restoration practices?
Well, we do in Tsleil-Waututh in general, we have a lot of initiatives going on. We have water quality, we have restoration. We're doing a number of things, and I think we always put it back to the people that use the area. Are you doing your part thinking about green energy, doing things differently, waste? And depending on how specific we want to get, it even goes into the way that you wash your clothes and the types of material that you use, because microplastics are a real thing. And what people don't know is that it comes from your laundry. So understanding that a lot of things are really interconnected, and everybody has a little bit to participate in. And even when you go to a beach, understanding that it is an ecosystem and that walking in the tidal area could be effectively stomping on someone's home. When I refer to someone, I mean resources, wildlife, marine environment.
Mm-hmm. So just being more mindful of the role that we all play within this ecosystem and the ways that we can sort of equitably coexist.
Yes, exactly. We're all neighbors. We all sort of have to live together. So, yeah.
Once again, that was our conversation with Michelle George, Tsleil-Waututh Nation's cultural and technical specialist, who spoke with us about the success of the nation's bull kelp restoration project, including the observed benefits that it's provided for local sea life populations. Again, you are listening to Speak Up only on CJSF 90.1 FM. This is Danny Nesvedarani. Thank you so much for tuning in thus far on this National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. Coming up next, we have a segment from our programming coordinator and also local journalist Jesse Wenzloff. This is from an event that he attended back in February of this year, the Kairos Blanket Exercise.
You guys are free, indigenous people. You guys can walk, Turtle Island here, talk to your friends.
Hello, friends. Hello, neighbors.
During a workshop at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, participants walk through the history of colonization in what is now Canada, providing an experiential learning opportunity for all involved.
Here today is the northern part of what we now know as North America, before the arrival of the Europeans. By standing on these blankets, you represent the indigenous people, the people who have been here since time immemorial. Long before the arrival of the Europeans, this land was our home to millions of First Nations people, and Inuit have been living here.
Telling history through an Indigenous perspective, the Kairos Blanket Exercise invites participants to witness, experience, and immerse themselves in the devastating impacts of European colonization on the original inhabitants of this continent.
You represent the First Nations, which were divided when the border between the United States and British Dominion of Canada was created. This border divides communities and cuts us off from each other.
You will be moved to separate blankets to represent the creation of this border. If you are part of the same family or community, it doesn't matter. Move now. So, with people close to one another, yes.
The event was facilitated by Moontide Reconciliation, with Lana Arnold taking the lead.
I'm from Upper Nicola Band in Merritt. From my dad's side, I'm from Saskatchewan Standing Buffalo Reserve. The blanket exercise goes over 500 years of history from the Indigenous eyes. We go over MMIWG, residential school, 60 Scoop, and other colonial violence that has happened to our people. And it's from an Indigenous view, so everybody in the room gets to experience from an Indigenous lens and to start to feel like what we're feeling. I think it's really important for people to feel kind of what we experience so they can have a better understanding of where we come from and that's when I notice they start seeing a change. Like, they realize, like, now it all makes sense.
Arnold says that beyond providing an opportunity for non-Indigenous participants to engage with the history of colonialism and participate in a small act of reconciliation, delivering the workshops has made a tremendous positive change in her own life.
About a year ago, when my mom, she was a short staff member, so she just threw me in there and said, you're going to be playing the European, and she's going to be the narrator, and she told me, and I didn't realize, like, I wasn't even in that part of my healing journey yet, and I realized, I was like, well, this is more than what I thought it was. I didn't know what to expect when you hear blanket exercise, so I was also shocked. I was like, oh, this is what we're doing. So when I started doing the workshop myself, I also started learning about my own culture and everything, and the truth. I started realizing the things I've gone through and with trauma and everything, it made me realize where I came from, and I forgave my family and everything that I've experienced.
The workshop is extremely impactful, and participants emerge with a revamped understanding of and empathy for Indigenous people.
Yeah, I've had people, a lot of emotions come out of it, like people cry, or you could tell they just realize, like, what we're going through. And for me, I don't want people to feel like kind of like pity or sorry. Like, I want people to just have respect for Indigenous people and treat us like humans and acknowledge us. Yeah.
It's a small step on the path to reconciliation, but the blanket exercise presents a unique opportunity to move forward on the long journey.
For me, I hope people take away, we're still here, we're resilient, and just to acknowledge us, to enjoy our culture and not look too much in the past. Like, it's important to look in our past, but we want to move forward and in a good way.
Please step off the blanket and join your ancestors in the circle. After these acts of resistance and fearing for your lives, many of you changed your names and moved away, sometimes as far as the United States. Some of you moved back to your First Nations families and joined these communities through adoption processes. Some of you hid or denied your Indigenous heritage altogether. These were the dark times for the Métis. There was a time of persecution and extreme poverty.
From Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia, I'm Jesse Wensloff for CJSF 90.1 FM. This story is made possible by funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative and is available online with stories from across the country at frequencynews.ca.
Thank you so much for listening to that segment. Next up, we have another news piece that I produced earlier this year. This is one that centers around a group of archaeologists here at SFU that are doing archaeology work at Lascidi or Huayatai, which is a very small remote island, and essentially doing the work that they're doing in order to educate the local population of that island of the Indigenous culture and history of that area, which had previously, according to them, not been super well known. And I think that's something that's really important when it comes to truth and reconciliation, is having that baseline education, having that baseline awareness of the history and culture of the area that you reside in. So take a listen to this piece. A group of researchers at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, BC, are using archaeology as a means of Indigenous reconciliation and heritage protection. The Huayatai Lascidi Archaeology Project, also known as XLAP, is working towards advancing reconciliation among the Indigenous and settler populations of Lascidi Island, which is a remote island located off the east coast of Vancouver Island in the Strait of Georgia. Starting in 2021, XLAP is continuously being worked on by a community of volunteers and researchers from both Indigenous and settler communities, as well as Indigenous knowledge holders from Comox Nation, Tohaamen Nation, Wiwakum Nation, Kualakum Nation, and Halalt Nation. Recently, a talk on XLAP was hosted by Dana Lipovsky, a professor of archaeology at SFU, leader of the XLab project,